From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Black critics on the expectations they wrestle with when assessing Black art, like the new movie Queen and Slim. Then, documentary filmmaker Eva Orner on the women who came forward to accuse yoga guru Bikram Chowdhury of sexual assault.
They risked everything. They were met with hatred and vitriol. They lost their jobs, they lost their community, they lost their friends, and they lost their livelihoods because he controlled their livelihoods.
And we revisit the pivotal scene from It's a Wonderful Life that was shot at Beverly Hills High School. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Queen and Slim is a film about a Black couple on the run after fatally shooting a white police officer when a questionable traffic stop turns violent. It was sure to start some conversations, but one that the filmmakers may not have foreseen is the discussion the film has sparked about what it means to be a Black writer who's critical of work created by Black artists. In this case, Queen and Slim director Melina Matsoukas and screenwriter Lena Waithe. Travell Anderson from Out Magazine and Cassie DaCosta with The Daily Beast are two Black writers with different takes on the film. Here's Cassie DaCosta.
So my feelings about the film were that while the premise, the ideas behind the film, which came from movements and activism that already exists, were strong, the way the film thinks through them is shallow and surface level. And it doesn't take the characters through a journey that actually is imaginative or original or takes on the ideas in a new way. It felt like a shallow regurgitation to me of those ideas.
Travell, what about you? What was your take on the movie?
I enjoyed the movie as a piece of cinema. I thought it looked amazing. I really enjoyed the direction. I agree on some of the points about the story itself, though. But my kind of opinion comes from this general slate of what I call the Black Lives Matter cinematic universe, which are all these different films that we've gotten over the last few years that seem to be inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement. They all talk about this element of freedom and liberation and revolutionariness, but then the Black person always dies at the end or something like that. And I think that's one of the kind of tropes that Queen and Slim falls into at the end of it.
Travell, I want to read something that you wrote on Twitter, and that is, I'm actually encouraged by all the conversation Queen and Slim has kicked up about Black art, Black critics, and criticizing Black art. Our art deserves to have these complex and varying, fiery and fierce, mixed and messy conversations, too. So I want to ask you not only about what you wrote, but about what kind of reactions you got to what you put on Twitter.
Well, I mean, I think when we look at criticism that is done by Black people, it more often and most often isn't allowed to be complex. It isn't allowed to be nuanced because our Blackness is already politicized in a particular way. And so many of us feel the obligation that, like, oh, I can't critique something in the way that I perhaps want to because this will endanger the chance for another Queen and Slim type of movie to get made in the future, right? And so we feel this obligation that we have to uplift everything or at least not criticize it publicly. When in reality, I think the type of community, the type of world, the type of kind of cultural production landscape that we're all looking for is one that allows Black art to be complicated and for it to be messy and for it to not necessarily hit and be the everything for everyone. And I think what we see from this particular conversation around Queen and Slim is that it seems like and it feels like we're at that place where people now are kind of shirking this kind of fiend responsibility that we've often felt. And we're now being able to have these fully well-rounded, nuanced conversations about art that is said to reflect our experiences.
As you have been processing the idea of how certain critics watch certain films, how do you think the ethnicity of the reviewer has factored into how this movie has been received?
I think that it's a factor. I think it's often a factor for most films, right? If not all films, your background, your ethnicity, as well as your class and your experiences in life are always going to affect how you review a film, even if you believe that you're very objective and methodical. And this is no exception. I think because this film makes a point out of representing certain themes and ideas that are very much about race, not only very much about race, but about the political aspects of how race is viewed in our society. Of course, Black people are going to approach the film through the lens of race and bring their own experiences into it. But I think it's important to remember that Black critics have had very different ideas about this film. We've approached it in very different ways. And the criticism I've seen from Black critics has been a lot more nuanced than what I've seen from critics who aren't Black with this film specifically.
I want to ask one last question, and that is, in a piece for The Guardian, the culture reporter Andre Wheeler noted that in the film, Slim says at one point, "Why do Black people always have to be excellent? Why can't we just be us?" And it connects to this idea of there being a higher standard that a film with Black people in front of and behind the camera might be held to. What do you make of that part of the argument and conversation?
It's obviously true. Black people are held to a higher standard in all professions. However, I would say as critics, our job is to evaluate films according to what we believe are the criteria for excellence. And so it's a little bit of a trap almost to apply that to critical work, to say that, to imply at least that critics have to give Black films a pass because Black people already have an undue burden of excellence placed upon them. I think that as critics, we all have our different sense of how we're going to evaluate things. You know, I always consider as a critic, who's produced the film? Did this film have a really hard time getting made and distributed? Did this film receive any marketing? And that helps me calibrate. If I don't like the film, am I going to write about it first of all? And how am I going to frame this criticism? And for Queen and Slim, I think this is a case in which this film had a lot of weight behind it. And a lot of people were going to see it whether I panned it or not. And so when I saw it and I didn't like it, I didn't have the same hesitance as I would for a film, whether or not the creators were Black, where I knew that probably very few people in the world, let alone this country, would see the film.
Travell?
Yeah, I think I just add that I think it is important that Black critics are allowed the same space and the same kind of flow with their work that white critics and mainstream critics, the folks that have the good paying jobs at all the newspapers, have, because we should want to be in a space where, however I feel about a film, I'm able to share it, and that doesn't have any impact on whether or not we see another Black film. But what we know is that we exist in an industry that still believes that Black films don't travel. And it will use Queen and Slim as an example for why we should or should not have other types of movies on this particular subject with these types of leads, with these types of directors and writers behind them, because that's the nature of the industry that we work in. But we're pushing and we're working towards one where that's not the particular case.
Travell Anderson is director, culture and entertainment at Out Magazine. Cassie DaCosta is an entertainment writer at The Daily Beast. Travell and Cassie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good job.
Coming up on The Frame, the man behind Bikram Yoga is at the center of a documentary detailing allegations of sexual assault against him.
Everybody's got opinions on nothing. Say we're flying down a path.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. In the 1970s, Bikram Yoga began rising in popularity in the United States, and the man selling the hot yoga practice as his own invention, Bikram Chowdhury, rose to fame and made millions by training others. Then, in 2013, women began saying that Chowdhury had sexually assaulted them, allegations that he denies. Six rape and sexual assault cases have been filed against Chowdhury. And though he's a fugitive from the United States, he continues to teach and profit from his method in other countries. His story is the subject of the new Netflix documentary, Bikram, Yogi, Guru, Predator. Here's the film's director, Eva Orner.
And I did some, you know, online research, and I thought, oh, there's something here. And what really got me was the fact that he'd gotten away with it. I thought there was something interesting in that part of the story. And this was pre-Me Too. So I think I didn't even realize how.
So this is like 2016, 2017?
2017, yeah. Okay. So it was a couple of years ago. And it's interesting because I thought, wow, this is an amazing story. And then Me Too happened when we were in production. And I thought, oh, this is going to land even better, I think.
So something that happened in Me Too also happens in your documentary. And that is that people feel if they come forward, it may cost their business, it may cost their practice of yoga, that the consequences for saying what has happened outweigh the benefits of saying this can't continue.
Yeah, and that's what's so heroic about these young women, because they were super young when they came out and they risked everything. They were met with hatred and vitriol. They lost their jobs, they lost their community, they lost their friends, and they lost their livelihoods because he controlled their livelihoods if they wanted to teach at Bikram Studios. And so they still came out and spoke. And I feel like it's different now. Now there is a level of support because of Me Too, but this was before then. So they really, really, really risked a lot. And I have so much admiration for them.
I want to ask you about the character that he created himself, because so much of it is fictional. There's stories about doing yoga with Richard Nixon, which are probably not true. There's stories about him being yoga champion that are probably not true. He seems to have created a lot of mythology around himself that either people didn't check or wanted to believe.
I think it's a combination of both. I think, you know, when you go on a talk show, a Tonight Show in the 70s, do people really fact check what you say when you're a guru coming from India? They just say what you tell them. And so the myth was sort of perpetuated by the media and by people. And no one really fact checked it till now. And a lot of people who own or owned Bikram Studios don't even know that he took the yoga from Bishnu Ghosh, his master, and just put his name on it. And that was one of the things that I really wanted, you know, to show in the film. And there's so many more stories like that. I mean, the film's only 86 minutes. We could have made another 3 or 4 hours. There are an enormous amount of things that he said that are not true. I think you can judge and say anything he says is incredibly questionable. And people often ask, you know, what was the story of his childhood and his life? And I always say, I mean, I don't know. I have 3 or 4 versions, but I can't ascertain what they are because not enough people are alive anymore. And also people in his inner circle, in his family, wouldn't talk to us. But it seems that he was actually from a pretty middle-class family in Calcutta. When we were there, I went to his childhood family home, and it was like a nice home by Calcutta standards at the time.
People who have done hot yoga know that part of the deal is everybody in the room is in it together, and the room can be as hot as 105 degrees with high humidity. And yet Bikram Chaudhary has a rule that kind of separates him from the rest of the people, and that is behind him, he has air conditioning. Everybody else is sweating like mad, and yet there are different rules for him. And I think that little image says a lot about how he considered himself above everybody else. There were different rules for him as there were for everybody else.
That's one of my favorite moments of the film, and it really shows him as the fraud that he is, that he has this piped air conditioning coming in on him while he's standing on his stage, sitting on his throne, screaming obscenities at people.
We're talking with Eva Orner about her documentary, Bikram, Yogi, Guru, Predator. One of the women in the film is Larissa Anderson, and she accused Bikram Chaudhary of rape, and it's one of the cases that actually did proceed. And I want to play a clip of her talking about how she saw Bikram Chaudhary when she first got into his yoga practice.
My impression of him was very godlike, even more so than a guru. Like, he knew everything about everything. After teacher training, I really, really, really wanted to have my own studio. But you have to get approval from Bikram before you sign the lease.
She's describing a couple of things. One is this kind of religious, almost messianic following that he has among people who practice yoga. And the other one is almost this kind of business pyramid scheme that he's running that people can't break away because they need his blessing. So I want you to describe more the grip that he had over people who not only followed him, but also practice his style of yoga.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on cults and I'm certainly not a psychologist, but this has all the makings of a cult. You know, it was about worshipping him. He put himself in a position of power. Where a lot of this happened was in teacher training, which is this 9-week course. It's sequestered, so you ultimately go to a hotel somewhere and there's 400 or 500 people, and you're there for 9 weeks doing yoga relentlessly. And he grooms young girls and, you know, picks his favorites. He gets them to do things for him, like massage him. He gets them to come up to his suite late at night, and that's where he makes his move. So in my head, and in a lot of people's heads, it's very cult-like. They had mantras like, we are your family, trust the process. I mean, it's pretty textbook, both cult and predatory behavior. And he was enabled by his whole group, his inner circle, who would support his whims.
Most of the time, yet there is somebody who works closely with him, who's in fact a lawyer named Mickey Jaffa Bowden, who starts to say to herself, I can't stay silent any longer. Why is she so important to this story?
She's important to this story. She comes into the story quite late, and she was complicit for some time, working for him as his head of legal affairs. And then when she became aware of what was happening, she brought it up with him and his wife, and she realized there was a problem in the organization, and she started kind of becoming a little threatening to them and saying things have to change here, and she was fired. And so she was smart and a lawyer, and she lawyered up, and she was the first one to take him to court civilly. So she's important because she's the one that got him to court, and she's the reason he's a fugitive in America now.
And yet it does feel like even though he's a fugitive in America, he hasn't completely gone away, and there have been bankruptcy proceedings. But everything I've read online and some of this happens after you finish your film, suggests that he is still doing what he's doing in terms of teaching. I don't know about sexually assaulting women.
It's very tricky with the American justice system because he has not gone through the criminal justice system. So he was found guilty unanimously by a jury here in Los Angeles in order to pay, you know, about $7 million to Mickey, and he fled the country. If the DA of Los Angeles would go after him criminally, for instance, like the DA in New York did with Harvey Weinstein after a long time of not going after him, then there would be a different situation. But criminally, he's never been charged. So it's very, very hard to bring him back to America to force him to pay a civil judgment. And he travels the world. He's based out of Calcutta. He has a mistress in Japan. He travels constantly. He was just doing another teacher training in Mexico. He's living the life. I mean, his life has been shrunk. He doesn't have his Beverly Hills lifestyle anymore, which he loved. He doesn't have his fleet of luxury cars. He doesn't quite have, you know, the shine he used to have. And I'm sure that eats away at him. But he still makes millions of dollars a year on teacher training and lectures and travels. And he has expressed no responsibility and no remorse and no guilt for anything.
I will admit that I practice hot yoga, not in any studio that has anything to do with Bikram, but I do find it really appealing and beneficial. I want to play a clip from a yoga teacher that you spoke to about the practice itself, and this is Patrice Simon.
The main thing to me and why I agreed to speak with you, Eva, is because this yoga is magical. It's a very powerful technique. I'll never stop doing it. I'll never stop promoting it.
So if we were to separate the practice of yoga from Bikram Chaudhary, is there some evidence that it's actually a good thing and can be healthy and restorative?
Yeah, and I thought it was really important in the film not to go after the yoga, but to go after the man. You know, he calls it Bikram yoga. He stole it from someone else. It's not like he created it. So I think hot yoga is great. If it works for you, it's healed a lot of people. It heals injuries. I had to do a bunch of classes because I had to get to know people and they wanted to know if I'd done the yoga. And it actually really helped me. I have some injuries. I thought it was great. Do I do it? No. I think it's got a little too much trauma attached to it for me after the film. But I think it's great. And I think the answer is exactly what you do, which is to go to a hot yoga studio, not a Bikram yoga studio. And so people say, what do we do? Take down the name, disassociate yourself from a criminal and an alleged rapist, an alleged sex offender, and a chronic pathological liar. Why do you want to be associated with him? It's pretty simple. And actually, I've already heard that this week, 3 studios in America have already announced they're changing their names. So, you know, the film's having an impact. It doesn't mean the yoga has to die. It means he can't be supported anymore.
Eva Orner is the director and producer of the documentary Bikram Yogi Guru Predator. It's available now on Netflix. Eva, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Up next on The Frame, the holiday chestnut It's a Wonderful Life has a famous swimming pool scene, and it was shot at Beverly Hills High School. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame. It's the holiday season, which means many of you will probably at some point watch It's a Wonderful Life. The 1946 Frank Capra classic that stars Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed was mostly shot on the old RKO Radio Pictures lot in Culver City, but one memorable scene took place at a one-of-a-kind high school gym in Beverly Hills. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving paid a visit.
The Beverly Hills High School Swim Gym was built in 1939, designed by an architect named Stiles O. Clements, who was also responsible for the El Capitan Theater. It's been used in a bunch of movies, from Clueless to the upcoming Ben Affleck basketball film The Way Back, but it became an unforgettable character in It's a Wonderful Life.
Hey, this is my band.
Oh, why don't you stop annoying
me? Well, I'm sorry. Hey!
George Bailey, played by Jimmy Stewart, is about to leave for college. He agrees to swing by his kid brother's high school dance, and he runs into his childhood friend Mary, played by Donna Reed. He notices how beautiful she's become, and they start to flirt.
Me? Oh, no, there's a little girl named Mary Hatch. That wasn't you.
Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes, the big Charleston contest!
George and Mary are having a ball doing the Charleston. Meanwhile, the dopey guy who'd been hitting on her goes off to sulk.
What's the matter, fella? Jealous? Did you know there's a swimming pool under this floor? And did you know that button behind you causes this floor to open up? And did you further know that George Bailey is dancing right over that crack?
Back to that classic movie in a bit. But first...
Here's the infamous swimming part of the swim gym.
Tim Ellis is the athletic director of the Beverly Hills Unified School District. He's giving me a tour.
This is the only swimming pool in the city of Beverly Hills.
Oh, wow.
So what happens is, good morning, Ahmad.
Good morning.
Ahmad's the keeper of the floor. He's the only guy around that can open and close it.
During the summer, Beverly Hills kids swim here from dawn to dusk. During the school year, it's the home for swim practice and water polo, as well as wrestling, volleyball, and basketball, made possible by the retractable wooden floor.
What I've been told is the motors on either end that power the floor came off of a World War I destroyer. They were the motors that raised and lowered anchors.
Up top, poolside, the closing of the floors is incredibly quiet. But down underneath... in the bowels of the gym, where the motors and pulleys are, it looks like the rusted remains of the Titanic. Sometimes, it works about as well.
When the cable breaks, all hell breaks loose. Just because the place is used constantly, and then it ends up... causing issues between the city and ourselves.
The school's had a restoration engineer come out to see if he can fix the 80-year-old system. They've also applied for historical monument status.
It's one of a kind. There's the only one in the United States, from what I understand, that is anything like this.
And that takes us back to that scene in It's a Wonderful Life. George and Mary dance away, blissfully unaware of the moving floor. Then they fall in the water. The students decide, what the hey, and they dive in too. One of those dancing, diving students was a young actress named Priscilla Montgomery Clark.
I was 17. It was the next to the last movie that I worked in prior to college.
Clark was a good dancer who lived in the area. As a kid, she'd had small parts in Little Rascals and even as a munchkin in The Wizard of Oz. As she got older, she was in movies with Cary Grant and Frank Sinatra. She got the job as a high school student in It's a Wonderful Life, which meant several days of rehearsal to learn the Charleston.
The Charleston scene isn't that long, but it's amazing the steps you learn so that you can do this.
On the day they shot the scene at the swim gym, director Frank Capra walked over to Clark and her dance partner.
Just prior to shooting the falling in the pool scene, and he said, would you and your partner be willing to start the momentum? It will be $50 extra, and that was on top of our salary, so gosh, that was huge, you know, in those days. But anyway, we would have done it anyway, and we said, well, sure.
When they showed up to set that morning, they had no idea they were going to be jumping into a pool with their clothes on.
No idea. The clothes got wet, the shoes, everything was ruined, everything. So one shot had to be perfect.
It was actually pretty dangerous. Dozens of bodies jumping into a pool at the same time, a drop of about 8 feet.
When I looked down, I thought, wow, that's going to be different, you know, because I love to dive, but this was falling in and no pretty dives. When you get wet, and sure enough, you go straight to the bottom, and you think you're never coming up. but it was just so much fun. What an experience.
In the film, that's the night George Bailey and Mary Hatch fall in love. And to think, it might not have happened if a gym floor in Beverly Hills didn't have a pool underneath. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
It's a Wonderful Life will air Christmas Eve on NBC, and it's available for streaming on Amazon Prime. And just a reminder before we go, you can keep up with The Frame through our weekly newsletter. Every Thursday, you'll get the backstory on one of our show segments, plus headlines from the world of culture and tips for how to spend your weekend. You can sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.